Romans chapter 1, beginning with verse 16. For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also for the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds, and four-footed animals, and creeping things. Therefore God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lusts of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason God gave them up to vile passions, for even their women exchanged the natural use for what is against nature. Likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust for one another, men with men, committing what is shameful, and receiving in themselves the penalty of their error which was due. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind, to do those things which are not fitting, being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness. They are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful, who, knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them. So we back up to verse 16. We're looking at the power of the gospel, and I could not remember exactly where we left off, so we're going to start with this slide. He says that he is not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, that is, having a mental state of humiliation or bashfulness or shyness. So he's not shy about the gospel. And I'm sure there's plenty of reason that he might have come to a place where he would be reluctant to speak the truth of the gospel. I mean, it wasn't like he was just accepted everywhere he looked, right? He, everywhere he went, there was opposition. There were people who, in terms of this world, had position and power and authority. He stood before governors and kings, and he says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. I'm not bashful about it. Even though it is a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Greeks, it's going to bring a response. It's not just received in a neutral attitude. That as the gospel is presented, it presents men in their sinfulness, God in His holiness, and it presents the need that we cannot accomplish in and of ourselves, and that evokes a response from sinful men. sinful mankind. He says that the gospel is the power, that is, it's containing the ability within itself. Let's look at 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 18. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through wisdom did not know God, it pleased God through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. For Jews request a sign and the Greeks seek after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block and to the Greeks foolishness. But to those who are called, both Jew and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 4. If someone would read that for us. And then 1 Thessalonians 1 and verse 5. Go ahead and read verse 5 as well. Okay, it is the power of God. 1 Thessalonians 1, 5. Remember, he is writing to believers in Rome and talking about power. I mean, that was the power center of the world, where there was a man sitting on the throne that claimed to be God and expected to be worshipped as a god. And all of that power structure, all of those that were seeking a place in that government, they were looking to be somebody. All of the wickedness that was involved in all of that. And he says, the gospel is the power of God. Never mind the power of Rome. Never mind the power of the emperor. I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it is the power of God. It is within the message itself, it contains the ability to produce a result. The word is the Greek word is the one we get our term dynamite from, but it kind of leads us in a wrong direction. As we think of dynamite, we think of explosive power. But they didn't have really an understanding of explosive power. They didn't know gunpowder and things like that. But sometimes you'll hear preachers take that term and say the gospel is God's dynamite. It's the explosive power of God. It's not the explosive power, but there is in it an omnipotent power of God in transforming the life of a sinner to become right with God, to completely transform our position before holy God. It is a loving message of mercy and grace. And when we think of things that are powerful, we don't generally think of those terms, mercy, grace, love. Powerful things in terms of this world, they would discredit the strength of mercy, the strength of grace. It says it's the power of God unto, or resulting in. It results in salvation. It results in deliverance, preservation, to be freed from the greatest evil and placed in a position of the greatest good. So there's looking at two sides of that. We're saved from something, but we're also saved to something. We're saved from the wrath of God. We're saved from the judgment of eternal hellfire and damnation and separation from God for all of eternity, but we're also saved to something. We're saved to a loving relationship with God. We're saved to sanctification. We're saved to glorification. We're saved to the adoption as sons. And so salvation is a deliverance, but it's also a preservation. It's taking us from the greatest evil and placing us in possession of the greatest good. He's not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. It is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes. That salvation comes through faith. And he makes that emphasis again in the next verse. He does say there, for the Jew first and also for the Greek. And it is a universal message. It doesn't matter who we are in this world. It is to anyone who by faith will call upon Jesus Christ to be their Savior, He will deliver them. And the message was presented first to the Jews because they were God's chosen people. He has a special relationship with them, but He opened that gospel up to all of mankind, the Gentiles. There's nobody in between. In biblical understanding of the world, there's only two groups. The Jews and the Gentiles. Now, we can divide those groups up in different ways, but really, there's just those two groups, and when they're both involved, there's nobody that stands outside of the ability, the message of the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's not kept back from any certain racial group, in terms of the way our world speaks of things. We know that there is only one race, that's the human race, brought about through Adam and then later through Noah. We all have common ancestor, but in terms of skin color or nationality or position, it's all equal. The gospel is presented to everyone. Anyone who would believe and respond by faith to the message of the gospel can be delivered. It says, for it is the righteousness of God, for in it the righteousness of God is revealed. It's important for us to understand the righteousness of God here. In our translations, it can kind of lead us astray a little bit. Righteousness here is the condition of righteousness or rightness, a right standing before God, which shows itself in behavior conformable to God. That's a quote from Cramer. That's a condition of rightness whose standard is God. I can't even read tonight. Sorry. A condition of righteousness whose standard is God, which shows itself in behavior conformable to God. I want to emphasize the condition. It's a standing. It's a reality. It's not just a behavior. It's not an action. It's not, in this case, we're not looking at the moral quality of God. We're looking at a condition of man in which he stands in a right condition according to the standard of God. That is, this world has an idea of righteousness, but it creates its own standard. And it's sad. You know, you see the moral individuals of our community, and they know that there are certain things that are right and certain things that are wrong, but they can't establish the basis of that right and wrong because they refuse to speak the reality that God exists. That moral standards don't come from personal interactions. Moral standards didn't just evolve, but moral standards come from God. It's transcended. It comes down from something greater than us. And so we're not measuring our right standing according to what you think is right for my life, what your neighbor may think is right for life. We measure this standard according to what God has determined is right. And so that is a standard which we could not measure up to except by the power of the gospel to place us in a right standing, to give us that condition of righteousness. So when it says that it's revealed the righteousness of God, it's really the granting to us of a standing of righteousness before God. This term righteous and its equivalents, just and justified, are going to be seen over 60 times in the book of Romans. And so we see this is going to be one of the key elements, the key themes as we go through this book. The righteousness of God in this situation, in this context, is God's righteousness imputed to the believer. Philippians 3, verses 8 and 9. If somebody could read that for me. Okay. It's not a righteousness of my own. It's not something that we generate. We talked about it this morning in Corinthians. It's the Spirit of God that's working in us. And the power of the gospel isn't that it generates a righteousness in our behavior that makes us acceptable to God, but that the power of the gospel places us in a condition of righteousness before God, not based upon our works, but based upon His faithfulness, His work, and we obtain that by faith in Jesus Christ. We argue that it's not the righteousness of God's character. It's not revealing the character of God here, because that is something that had been done previously. The law exposed the sinfulness of man by showing us the righteousness of God. The gospel is revealing something new, something that is previously unseen, unknown. And that is that the righteousness of God is placed upon the believer. It says this, from faith to faith. It's an expression that shows us that from start to finish, there is nothing in the gospel message that places us in a right condition with God that comes from our works. And that is the real stumbling block to humanity, because mankind in his sinfulness always wants to have something to do to make himself viable, to make himself desirable. It's the pride of the human heart. And so we have to set that aside. I cannot do anything. All of my righteousness is as filthy rags. It is only by faith and God's grace of giving me a righteous standing before Him. This term faith is also going to be an important one as we go on through the book. Faith is mentioned 60 times. Faith or unbelief is mentioned 60 times throughout this book. So we'll see that many more times. The word means trust, confidence, a settled conviction, or a full dependence. So of those definitions, what definitions connects with you? That gives, you know, that kind of, oh yeah, that's what faith is, kind of a full dependence. Okay. Trust. I know faith has been illustrated many, many times in many different ways. It always connects with me, that full dependence, when you think of relying on a chair or something when you sit down. You're placing your full dependence on that chair to uphold you, to have full trust, to be of a settled conviction that I know this chair will hold me. You know, and sometimes we find that that's not true, right? I mean, we take a folding chair and we stand up on it to change a light bulb. And that's not what the chair was for, but we were of such a settled conviction that we placed everything dependent upon whether that chair was in good condition and able to hold you up. And sometimes when you get up there and that chair fails you, but our faith in Jesus Christ is never going to be disappointed. We have full dependence upon Jesus. We say, I rely only upon Jesus and His shed blood to save me from my sin. I'm not relying on anything else or anybody else. My parents can't save me. My church can't save me. My works can't save me. I can't be good enough. I can't add to this. Jesus, when He died on the cross, did a complete work of salvation, and God promised me that if I believe it, He will save me for all of eternity. And I have to be fully convinced in it, not relying upon anything else. For in the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. We see he adds that last statement, the just shall live by faith, to demonstrate that he wasn't creating something new, but that that was the reality of the Old Testament as well. The Old Testament law could not save. The Old Testament believers were saved by faith. That has always been the case. They always looked to God to produce the salvation that they themselves could not accomplish. And you'll see that as you read some of the Psalms. And so in the next verse we have, it starts with the word for. And so he's connecting the thought process here. He's about to go into the courtroom and demonstrate the guilt of all of mankind. He's going to make a argument. He's going to present the case and prove that everyone is guilty. But he wants to tie that back to the previous verse. And so we need to understand that salvation must come by faith alone, because mankind is under the wrath of God. That which stirs wrath can in no way appease God. You see the connection there. Salvation by faith alone, we receive the righteousness of God, because all of mankind is under the wrath of God. Everything about mankind is under the wrath of God. And so whatever mankind can produce is not going to produce an appeasement to God. It's not going to solve the problem. The wrath of God is revealed. That's not a statement of judgment. It's not God's condemnation there, but God's emotional response to human sin, to human sinfulness. It is a righteous anger and a hatred of sin which finally will reveal itself in judgment. So what we need to realize, and I think would be beneficial to us, is to remember how evil, how wicked, how God is angry at sin and at the sinner. that there is an emotional response from God because of his holiness and his righteousness and his justice. He cannot stand sin in his presence in any way. It is an absolute offense to him. Kids, what are some of the things that you want to keep as far away from you as possible? You want to keep it just, you don't want to be around it at all. It just really makes you disgusted. Spiders? Okay. Anything that kind of makes you sick? What else? What else gets you upset? What puts you, you don't want to be around it. Get away from me. Let me leave the room. Tomatoes. Well, that's a little different. Tomatoes. Okay? That's a repulsive to Noah. He does not like tomatoes. Okay? It's kind of hard when you got little infants and they get sick. And some people really have a hard time with that. They can't deal with it and they get sick themselves. I never had quite that response, but it wasn't something you wanted to be around. I'm just like, I'm glad Don is taking care of that one. I married a good woman there, right? Sin in any form is like that to God. He has an emotional response to sin that is anger, and he wants to keep it as far away from him as possible. It's an abomination to him. But as you and I live in this sin-filled world, we become calloused to that. We don't have the same emotional response to sin that God has. It's kind of like when I was running garbage route. Well, when I first started running garbage route, that was disgusting. I mean, the back of that garbage truck smelled awful, especially on rainy, wet times in the middle of summer, and that you just had some of the worst stuff going into that garbage truck. And after I'd been working on the garbage truck for a while, you know what I started doing? I started bringing food. I had run the garbage route for a while, but I was running a rural route. You didn't have any place to stop and clean your hands or anything, but I had become callous to the situation, to the place that I was able to sit there in my garbage truck and eat food. It gets worse. Because that's normally up in the cab of the truck, right? I mean, that's kind of separated from the business end of the truck. But when I come here and started working with Miriam and those, and I would be riding on the back of the truck. And it comes break time, and we're in a hurry. We want to keep going. We want to get done as soon as we can. So we stop at Casey's, and we buy donuts, and we stand on the back of the truck while we're throwing the garbage into the back of the truck, eating our donuts. We become calloused to what ought to be absolutely offensive to us. Then we started getting the donuts out of the dumpster that the Casey's had. Okay. But see how that works. We are exposed to this stuff every day of our life. And people around us in this world do not comprehend the absolute, deplorable, repulsive abomination that sin is. And we're being told every day, well, these things are just a choice. And it's your choice, it's their choice, it doesn't bother me. And we can become desensitized to the abomination of sin, which produces in God a wrath, a righteous anger and hatred of sin that one day is going to be poured out upon mankind in absolute judgment. It's wrath against ungodliness. Ungodliness is the lack of reverence toward God. This is man's attitude toward God. The big guy upstairs. You know, there's no honor. There's no respect. There's no reverence. There's no elevating the person of God in their thinking. It's always about bringing God down to their level, adjusting God to something that they can understand and manage. It is the unrighteousness, that is the deeds that violate the law. This is man's action. So we have sin in man's attitude and sin in man's actions. And really this is man's sin against man, his deeds against other men. And it tells us that they have a knowledge of the truth, but they are suppressing it. They hold it. They hold it down. They have made a willful choice to choose sin and reject the truth. And they suppress it even by their own unrighteous behaviors. You know, they can't accept that there is a God because they desire and lust after and pursue things which they know that if there is a God, he would hate. And so I choose my sin and I deny the fact that there is a God. I deny the conscience that is within me that tells me that there is a God. I deny the evidence around me that points to the fact that there is a God. He tells us here that man has an internal testimony which responds to the created world. In verse 19, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. They have chosen to deny the reality of a creator. They look at the world around them, and it is absolute evidence that there is a God, and his invisible attributes are apparent. But they close their eyes to the evidence and they say, no, there is no God, there is no creator, we all came from something else. Nature made itself. If you look at creation, you can see that there is a God, that he created all things. If he created everything, then he's got to be bigger than you. Right? He's got to be greater than you, and therefore he deserves respect. He deserves to be worshipped. And so we're dealing with the very basic element. I mean, we're not even talking about saving faith or anything here. We're just looking at the depravity of man is such that when he looks at the clear evidence that God has placed in the world around him, and the testimony which he has placed within their conscience, that man designs to ignore the Creator and to explain it away and not give him the honor and glory for what he's done. It's an unjust response. They do not honor him as God, and they are not grateful. Worship and thanksgiving. Again, we're not talking about saving faith at this point here. We're just talking about an acknowledgement that there is a God and that I am grateful that God exists and that he created this world and he created me, and all of his work is marvelous. That mankind so suppresses the truth that they cannot even be thankful for those things. And therefore, they are without excuse. That is, God has given them clear evidence. He's placed it in their heart, and they've refused it, and they will have no defense when they stand before God. Because they have done this, they have become futile. In verse 21, because although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. As we look around the world around us and you question, why are people not thinking? Why can't people reason? Why can't people understand? Why is there no thought processes going on here? Well, it's because they've been given over. Their minds have become futile. They're empty. They're vain. They're foolish. And they're foolish. That is, they're unintelligent. They're without understanding. You've got to be careful to understand what that's talking about. There are some very brilliant unbelievers in things of this world. But the one thing that must be understood, the real realities of life and eternity, they are absolutely uneducated in. They have absolutely no understanding of spiritual things. They are without understanding of what is real and what is real important. Their foolish hearts were darkened. That is, they are deprived of light. They are covered with darkness. Their eyes of understanding have been covered. What's that sound like? You've heard that recently? Maybe on Sunday morning? 2 Corinthians? You're killing me. Yeah, we forget. Can't even remember from morning to evening, I tell you. 2 Corinthians chapter 3. Chapter 4, verse 3. But even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, whose minds the God of this age has blinded, who do not believe lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. The veil remains on those who are of unbelief. The veil is removed in Christ. Their understanding, the eye of understanding has a veil over it. They cannot see, they cannot comprehend, they cannot reason it out, they cannot understand it. They do not see the light. The light may be shining, but a blind man won't see it. There's a story I read years ago. There was a mine explosion. And it took several days for them to get down to the men that had been trapped down there. And they had sat there in darkness for days. And finally, they called, they found them, and they called for a light. So they sent a light through a small hole to reach into the men so that they could have a little bit of light. And one of the men's stood there and stared at the light and said, "Where's the light? I thought you were bringing a light." In the explosion, something had happened. He'd gotten injured and was blinded. Everybody else in the room saw the light, but the blinded man could not see that there was a light in the room. And that's the unbelieving heart. It's got a veil. It cannot see the light of truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Professing to be wise, they became fools. They changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things. And there's a lot of verses. We're running out of time. Let's look at Isaiah chapter 44. In verse 6, Thus says the Lord, the King of Israel and his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts, I am the first and I am the last. Besides me, there is no God. And who can proclaim as I do? Then let him declare it and set it in order for me, since I appointed the ancient people and the things that are coming and shall come. Let them show these to them. Do not fear nor be afraid. Have I not told you from that time and declared it? See here that God is the only God. He is full knowledge of all things. And then he starts to talk about the idols. In verse 9, those who make an image, all of them are useless, and their precious things shall not profit. They are their own witnesses. They neither see nor know, that they may be ashamed. Who would form a god or mold an image that profits him nothing? Surely all his companions would be ashamed. And the workmen, they are mere men. Let them all be gathered together. Let them stand up, yet they shall fear. They shall be ashamed together. The blacksmith with the tongs works one of the coals, fashions it with hammers, and works it with the strength of his arms, even so he is hungry, and his strength fails. He drinks no water and is faint. The craftsman stretches out his rule. He marks one out with chalk. He fashions it with a plane. He marks it out with a compass. He makes it like the figure of a man, according to the beauty of a man, that it may remain in the house. He cuts down cedars for himself. He takes the cypress and the oak. He secures it for himself among the trees of the forest. He plants a pine, and the rain nourishes it. Then it shall be for a man to burn, for he will take some of it and warm himself. Yes, he kindles it and bakes bread. Indeed, he makes a god and worships it. He makes it a carved image and falls down to it. He burns half of it in the fire. With this half, he eats meat. He roasts a roast and is satisfied. He even warms himself and says, "Ah, I am warm. I have seen the fire." And the rest he takes, and the rest of it he makes into a god, his carved image. He falls down before it and worships it, prays to it, and says, "Deliver me, for you are my God." They do not know nor understand, for he has shut their eyes so that they cannot see, and their hearts so that they cannot understand. And no one considers in his heart, nor is there knowledge, nor understanding to say, I have burned half of it in the fire. Yes, I have also baked bread on its coals. I have roasted meat and eaten it. And shall I make the rest of it an abomination? Shall I fall down before a block of wood? He feeds on ashes, and a deceived heart has turned him aside, and he cannot deliver his soul, nor say, is there not a lie in my right hand? Now, we don't live in a world where there's a lot of carved images that we bow down to, though we wouldn't probably have to go very far in our studies of current cultures to see that there are some that do that. But there are the same equivalent. They're saying here that here man takes a piece of nature, a tree. He cuts it up. He uses his tools and his skill and creates something that looks nice, looks like the beauty of a man, so that it can stay in the household and be appreciated. And he bows down to that piece of wood and honors it as his creator. How foolish, how stupid to say the nature created itself. They have no understanding. They cannot see it. They are so blinded to it, they cannot believe that they have a lie in their hand. But that is exactly what our culture is doing and is pushing and has been for generations, to say that nature has created itself. There is no God. Man can do with nature whatever he pleases to do with it. It's just there to be explored and experienced. And we've got to protect it, or else it's going to be demolished. It's so fragile. But we're worshiping it and denying that there is a God who created all things. Our culture is as blind as a culture that actually bows down to a wooden image, because they've denied that there is a God who created them.